This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hello, good evening, everybody. Welcome to this evening's session of the F Word. It's, I think, the eighth in a 10-part series here at the Wheeler Centre. The topic this evening is feminism and Aboriginality. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and to pay my respects to their elders, past and present. We have one panellist who was unfortunately unable to make it this evening, Kelly Briggs, but we will be referring to some of her work, and hopefully all of you will go away this evening and read some of it, because she really does some fantastic commentary. I'll start by introducing you to our incredible panellists this evening. And when I was reading these bios, I did have the feeling that they were incredibly modest bios. I thought, I know that both of you do so many more things. So, Melissa Lukashenko, over the far side. Melissa is a Guri writer whose work celebrates Aboriginal people and others living on the margins of the First World. Her most recent novel, Mullumbimby, was longlisted for the Miles Franklin Literary Award and the Stella Prize. It was shortlisted for the Kibble Literary Award and won the Queensland Literary Award for Fiction and the Victorian Premier's Award for Indigenous Writing. So welcome, Melissa. And next we have Celeste Little. Celeste is a proud Arende woman, traditional owner in Central Australia, who was born in Canberra and has been living in Melbourne for 21 years. She's the current National Indigenous Organiser for the National Tertiary Education Union and also serves on the Women's Action Committee. Prior to working for the NTEU, Celeste worked for the University of Melbourne, the Victorian College of the Arts in Indigenous student support and recruitment, and was active in the NTEU branch and division for many years. Celeste is also a guest columnist for Daily Life and for The Guardian Australia, and she blogs personally at blackfeministranter.blogspot.com. So I thought I'd start... My name's Maxine Beniba-Clark. I'll be your host for this evening. I thought I'd start by finding out a little bit, I guess, about how our panellists came to feminism, which is what the first question I tend to ask at these events. So we might start with Melissa. I guess I'm wanting to know a little bit more about when you knew feminism was a concept, whether it was overt, or whether you grew up with strong feminist role models in your life.
I grew up with strong women around me, my mother in particular, but the language of feminism was never used in our house at all. And I guess the first time I would have identified myself as a feminist would have been around about the age of 20, I suppose, when I got to uni and got radicalised, for want of a better word. The example my mother set was that women not only could do anything, but they had to do everything. So it's a double-edged sword of being a strong woman that also means that you are the strong woman who therefore, you know, keeps the family together in lots of ways. But having said that, I grew up in a patriarchal family at the same time, so mum wielded a lot of stoic power. Then later in life, I got more exposure to a lot of older Aboriginal women who... I guess we're more feisty than mum. My mum was a survivor and a stoic, patient woman who just endured and endured and endured. But meeting people like Auntie Barb Cummings in Darwin, Auntie Jackie Huggins in Brisbane, the late Yazola Best in Logan City, women that... And Auntie Maureen Watson, you know, women that would take a fight up to absolutely anyone, including, in the case of Auntie Maureen, punching coppers out at a demo one day. so a wide variety, but the language of feminism came to me pretty late.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Celeste?
I've been an identifying feminist since I was 15, mm-hmm. So I think that's when I discovered the word, and I took on the title Ms. because, you know, Miss had nothing. I didn't see the point of being identified from marital status, and even though I wasn't actually legally allowed to get married at 15, it didn't seem to matter. So I took that sort of stance at about 15, and I was an identifying feminist in high school to the point of where there was an open mic day in about year 11 where I got up and told everyone to throw away their razors and, you know, grow their armpit hairs long and all that, because I think that, you know, at that stage, while I was an identifying feminist, I think the depth of my knowledge grew again, like at uni, when I started grappling a bit more with concepts and experiencing the world in different ways. But I think that I'd always agitated from a really young age, and like I was incredibly aware of my Aboriginal identity, so I was incredibly aware of the constraints that I felt placed upon me by being a girl. So everything from, I'd cut my hair off at 11 years old. I resisted any sort of pretty frocks or that people tried to doll me up in, and I was always accused of being a really contrary sort of kid who was always asking why. So yeah, I was very aware of the constraints that was placed upon me from who I was, and I worked through those at a fairly young age. My mother too, covertly, she's also a very strong woman, but a survivor as well. And we did have that same sort of patriarchal dynamic, or similar, I'd say, in my family. But Mum would covertly slip me bits of feminism. So I remember that, you know, she got me books like Every Girl to Understand the Body, or she'd get me, I think it was the Virginia Trioli book when I was about 13, and she'd be slipping these little bits of feminism in. So she, you know, yeah, she was trying to broaden our dialogue, but also my mother's a white woman and my dad's an Aboriginal one, and I think that my mother got incredibly aware because she would have to be fighting for us on a race basis in the schooling system as a white woman, and trying to navigate that system, you know, the white mother of Aboriginal children trying to deal with racism and learning it all right there on the spot. But through that, she also kind of got aware of those sort of gender dynamics, that she'd be trying to build us up to be strong in who we were in whatever way she could. So slipping a bit of feminism in with the meal at night or something was her way of doing it, yeah.
And the issue of intersectionality, Melissa, has feminism always been interconnected with race politics for you? Is it necessarily interconnected?
Yeah, well, my Aboriginality was really weak and undefined until my late teens, sort of almost 20 as well. My identity was more as a karate person, and I was going to wear my karate medals tonight, but they've got that horrible Australian flag on them because I came third in the Australian karate titles twice, so I just couldn't stomach wearing that flag. Yeah, so my identity was about being very working class and being a karate adept. And I guess it was, I don't know, I grew up in a family and a microculture that just thought men exercising power was really normal and really okay, and where acts of fairly extreme patriarchal violence and silencing were just something that you took and survived and got around. I was talking to this cab driver in Brisbane this morning, and we started talking about police for some reason, and I sort of quickly let him know that I agreed with him that you get the odd decent copper, but most of them are just, you know, enmeshed in a culture of racism and sexism and homophobia and just revolting violence. And I was going somewhere with this. He started to say to me that, he told me this story. He was white. His girlfriend, I assume, was white, had been working in a cop shop. The copper put the hard word on his girlfriend. She said no, he went to rape her. This is a white girl. She punched him and escaped, went into work the next morning, and they said to her, "What are you doing here? You've assaulted a police officer. Get out." So she lost her job over it. And then, in almost the next breath, this guy said something like, "Oh, but it takes all sorts, doesn't it? You know, life would be pretty straight without the twisties." And I said, "Well, that's crime. You're talking about criminal violence." But this is the kind of attitudes almost that I grew up with. If you didn't have the protection of a man, then that was what you could expect in life.
Mm. And so the discovery of that kind of overtly feminist critique as an older person, did it feel like that was something you'd been waiting for?
It was a revelation to meet middle-class people who thought not all men cheated, not all men bashed, not all men. And I hasten to say that my father was not like that. My father was a good man, to me anyway. It was like, oh, there's this whole other world. There's these creatures called middle-class men who don't behave in that way, and there's these creatures called middle-class white women who don't expect to be treated like that and don't expect to need the patronage of a male figure to live in a semblance of safety. Mm. So from that point in my early 20s, I then saw that there was other options open to me.
And Celeste, in your essay on intersectionality and the post-colonials, you talk about this moment of being pushed, you know, when you're in primary school and pushing back and realising that, you know, as a girl and as a brown girl, those things are so, you know, interconnected in terms of that kind of, you know, violence or perception. Has feminism always intersected with race for you in that way?
Yeah, it has. And it's been really, really fascinating to me at the age I am now and with the sort of profile that I've been growing over a few years to be described as an intersectional. I'm always on that thing.
They've got it on computers now, I believe.
Yeah. It's newfangled things that we've been tapping into. When I went to school, we didn't have the internet. An intersectional feminist. So that was a label that was actually put upon me. But the thing is, I don't know any other way to come about this. Mm. I mean, these are my politics. This is my identity. I've always been Aboriginal. I've always been, you know, a girl or a woman, and I've always been from a working class background. And so, you know, maybe that means intersecting, but I always interpreted it as a fairly sort of radical idea that those at the bottom of the bottom of the ladder are the ones that need the most assistance, and once they're liberated, everyone else is. But that incident happened at primary school when I was 5 years old, and that was I was in Canberra, so it was kindergarten, but I believe it's called prep here. This other little five-year-old girl in class pushed me and called me brown bum. Mm. And it wasn't dealt with by the teachers, and indeed my school report at the end of that year was, "Celeste is a very conscientious student and, you know, has made great strides in her reading and her math this year. She just needs to learn how to watch her temper." Because I kind of went off my nut after I'd been pushed, which I think's, you know, a fairly reasonable thing. But that was in my life, you know, growing up in Canberra, where there was a fairly sort of a strong bunch of Aboriginal family around me. So when my family was living there, my dad, a lot of his cousins and uncles and that were working in the public service at the same time. The Tent Embassy was going on, you know, the land rights movement was in full flight. So I'd had a lot of that sort of community around me at a very young age. And I think that at 5 years old in primary school, that was the first time that it was pointed out to me that I was different racially. Mm-hmm. And that was an issue. But it had been pointed out to me before then that, you know, I was different in a gender perspective as well. And I'd observed that as a little girl, because in a lot of those movements, you'd see these angry black men talking about rights and all of that. And meanwhile, the women would be running around after the kids or trying to get food going or everything else. So, you know, the men would be thinking they were running this stuff. Meanwhile, the women were pretty much, told that they had to do everything else. And I got aware that that was what would probably be expected of me, as opposed to being one of those angry sort of people ranting on about politics, which I've failed, clearly. I don't do that now. But, yeah, I don't know anything. And the concept of money. We weren't a moneyed family, and I did go to a public school as a little kid in Canberra, but nearly everyone went to public schools in Canberra because, you know, it's kind of, you've got your left-wing white-collar sort of workers, so there's a real investment in the idea of public education, public health and that. So you'd experience those sort of... Was it moneyed strata within that sort of environment who had the better shoes? And we never did. And we never had the better clothes. We always had to wear school uniform because we didn't have anything else to wear. So, I don't know how to be anything but an intersectional feminist or an intersectional Indigenous activist or an intersectional unionist. These are all things that I am and have always been.
Yeah, and... Just hearing you talk, Celeste, makes me reflect that if you look at Aboriginal tradition on the East Coast, at least, I have no authority on anything much, but I can speak about the East Coast area a little bit. Intersectionality is what's built in to the nth degree in traditional culture, because it's all about a flat hierarchy. In some areas... Nations are patriarchal or matriarchal, but even in that context, you know, hierarchies are flat, power is shared, and I think there was a Guardian article the other day pointing out that knowledge transmission through stories is always... it's always taking note of different voices, you know. The holding of knowledge is never in the hands of one or two people. It's spread... far and wide, and that means that stories can be passed down over thousands of years, and that to me is intersectionality, because it means women are important, men are important, the trees are important, the rivers are important, the stars are important. So if you want to expand intersectionality out, you know, as far as it can possibly go, I would say that is East Coast Aboriginal culture.
Yeah, no, I'd say, I mean, even similar with the blocks of stories. So traditionally things like corroboree go on for days rather than, you know, 20-minute ceremony. It was because different parts of the story were being brought together and then transmitted in the same area. So, you know, people were knowledge keepers of that, but also to the way that families were structured, you know, based on skin and that, someone who was a female could be referred to as my father or, you know...
Yeah.
There were those sorts of variations, so,
And I believe in Bundjalung tradition, one belief, which wouldn't have been universal necessarily, but one belief was that if you're male in this life, you'll come back female in the next, and vice versa. So, you know, that embeds into a culture an idea that you better look... after the other gender, you know, in a respectful way, because it's going to be your turn next.
I want to perhaps pick up on something you said, Celeste, talking about this idea of if you liberate the most oppressed people, then everyone else is liberated, which is something that, as you talk about in your essay, came out of the early 70s Kambahi collective, feminism, women of colour in the States. And I wanted to talk to Melissa because I know you've had the opportunity to interact with luminaries like Angela Davis and Alice Walker in Australia over the last year or so, to ask you to speak about perhaps the connections and the differences between women of colour feminism and Indigenous feminism as a distinct entity and idea, I guess.
That's a pretty broad question. I guess what struck me when I first met Angela Davis about 15-odd years ago at a Sisters Inside conference was her unswerving commitment to revolution on class grounds as well as on race grounds and gender, although I don't remember her talking about gender as much, you know. I think Auntie Angela is first and foremost someone who wants to upend the economic and political system of the states, the US, you know. She talks about prisons as a place, as a site of racial and economic violence, and that prisons as warehouses where modern capitalist societies warehouse their social problems rather than actually dealing with them, which would mean fundamentally changing the economies. In terms of how that differs from Indigenous feminism, I guess the focus on land is different, for a start, the focus on country. You know, Celeste and I are committed to particular places in ways that other feminists will never be. But what do you think, Celeste? I'm not...
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So, I mean, there is a real link, I think, when you're talking... Well, and I very strongly got that from Auntie Angela as well, just the sort of her focus of on the economic system and the political system and how that would liberate as opposed to preferencing maybe feminism, so preferencing communism, yeah. But, there's links. So talking from that same sort of experience of being racially marginalised. I need another coffee. or maybe a martini. It's after five. But, racially marginalised, that sort of experience is reasonably shared. So there's some bridges and there's some things that we can learn from that. And I remember that Combahee River statement, and particularly that little part in it, was a real sort of light bulb moment for me, because it's sort of course, you know, black women in their context, they were talking about the liberation of black women would lead to the liberation of everyone else.
I don't know about that. I'm actually sceptical about that.
I'm sceptical insofar as I've sort of started interpreting it from an Indigenous perspective and the displaced peoples within their own lands versus those, yeah.
There's that, but there's also, in a way, that's essentialising black women as if to say if we had equal say and equal roles in society that we wouldn't be behaving in, you know, as assholes, basically.
Well,
you know, and you would hope that's the case. You would hope that our traditions and our role models would lead us not to act that way, but I'm not sure. But
yeah.
I mean, the thing with the difference between Angela Davis and Alice Walker's philosophies, which I think are radically different. Alice Walker is she's someone who's prepared to take radical action, as you can see in how she's behaved around the Palestine issue. But she, I think, is much more grounded in the natural world. She writes a lot more about relationship to earth. And she grew up in rural Georgia, I think. And, you know, she writes about country in a way that's much closer to the Indigenous tradition. And she also writes about love, where Auntie Angela Moore writes about the need to overthrow the shackles. In this country, there's a debate going on underground in Aboriginal culture about what place, if any, violence has got in our struggle. Okay, I think that's an issue that needs to be thought about a lot more and talked about a lot more. You know, I would call myself a social democrat and a pacifist, but there comes a point where people are asking, is anything going to change? Are we still going to be bashed 31 times more than white women? Are our children going to be suiciding? Are we going to be driven off traditional lands if our resistance doesn't change form? I hope those things can change without us needing to shed blood. But, you know, that's the debate, and that's the difference between Angela Davis and Alice Walker, I think.
And that, just going back, for people who don't know, the Combahee River Collective and Statement really grew out of women of colour's objection to white feminism, I guess, and the way that it excluded them. And, of course, we can't talk about Aboriginality and feminism without talking about the ways in which white feminism in this country has failed Indigenous women. And Celeste, you wrote a piece, about talking about the importance, I guess, of white feminism to be more inclusive, really.
I mean, and just to draw on Kambahi again, it was, I guess, what was also fascinating to me was the whole sort of, there was a lot of push and pull in it. So when they were talking about the issues with white feminism, and, you know, they were identifying black lesbian feminists, but felt that due to the struggle as black people, they, you know, were not able to participate in separatism, so lesbian separatism. They felt excluded by that because they walked alongside their brothers in the struggle on the race front. There were so many things that I was sort of pulling out of that. But on one hand, with mainstream feminism, I say that it's very much a part of... It's a part of Aboriginal women's experience as well due to the process of colonisation. So the sorts of struggles that white feminists have are also struggles that Aboriginal feminists have, but there's a whole extra layer there that's due to being First Peoples and those sorts of struggles. And some of the things that I tend to bring up, which have been brought up by Aboriginal feminists long before I have, but, you know, the struggle between, the 60s and 70s struggle between the access to birth control and an abortion versus, you know, just the right to be able to keep your families together. And Aboriginal women back then, when those struggles were going on, were saying, well, I've never had trouble accessing abortion, and, you know, I know women who've been injected with birth control for years against their will. And, you know, even if we fast forward to today, I mean, things like the Northern Territory intervention, and people were and even the Stop the Forced Closures of the communities, and the fact that Aboriginal women's voices will be used all the time as an argument for these sorts of policies to put in place without actually talking to these Aboriginal women and seeing what what they thought about it. So, you know, we're stopping the force... I mean, sorry, we're going to close these communities because there's an issue of domestic violence against the women in the community. But how about speaking to the women and what they want? So that... I think that, you know, we do deal with the mainstream feminism through colonisation, but that additional level of experience due to First Peoples' experience and the displacement often gets left out and needs to form a bit more of the dialogue.
Yeah. There's a phrase in Bunjalung which is binang gunj. Binang gunj. Binang means ear and gunj means broken. And it's the experience of most Aboriginal women I know that the capacity of mainstream Australia to listen, like really listen, not just stop talking while we talk and then start talking again, is really limited, and that it's frustrating not just because the Aboriginal women's experience doesn't get to be voiced and understood, but because the whole debate then can't go to a more sophisticated level. You know, there's been 60 or 80,000 years of feminism here. There's been 60 or 80,000 years of people working out how to live respectfully together. There's been 60 or 80,000 years of women raising families and being economic managers and being religious leaders and doing all the kinds of things that we would want to do today. And it's a matter of mainstream Australia actually understanding that there's stuff that they can learn from us. Not that, you know, not extend a helping hand to lift us up to your level, but to actually shut up long enough to understand that there are things that you're ignorant about, that there is wisdom and leadership in Aboriginal women and in Aboriginal men that can benefit the whole country.
That's the thing, yeah, that continual paternalistic approach, and you put it better than what I was saying, but the fact that Aboriginal women in particular will be subjected to more government regulation, more policies, more sort of... And we'll have to... I mean, Aboriginal women are the biggest survivors in this country because... You know, they've had to try in the face of violence through the frontier wars, beyond the frontier wars, keeping families together, anything beyond that. It's been Aboriginal women that have had to keep rolling on and keep pushing through. So that idea of Aboriginal women's strength, although it tends to get... it tends to always get coupled with the idea that we're the backbone and the strong, silent ones in the background rather than the ones who have been rolling on and fighting for such a long time, seems to get ignored in the face of the mainstream media, in government policy, in anything that can be imposed upon to regulate these women. And
yeah, because there's nothing more dangerous than a black woman who knows she's powerful and free.
Yes, yeah.
But I've got to tell you a story. A little short story. There's this... How's that mic? Is that all right? Okay. There's this woman doctor in Brisbane, and she's a, you know, well-intentioned woman, wants to help the community, great. And she works in reproductive health. So she goes out to Central Australia, out to the lands where the nuclear... the Maralinga type area.
Yeah.
I think it was that area. Don't quote me on that. And with the posters of how to understand, like how to do the birth control and the, you know, look after yourself, pap smears, all that sort of thing. And she'd done her homework, so she knew that she had to take an Aboriginal health worker with her, and she knew that only women could talk to the women and men would talk to the men. So the men doctors and health workers went off with the men and she went with the Aboriginal health worker and sat down with the women. So they all sit down somewhere in the shade, and the health worker says, this lady's here to tell us all about women's business, you know, your insides and how to stay healthy and strong. And she gets out her posters with the picture of the uterus and the ovaries and the birth canal, all that, and she explains about ectopic pregnancies, fallopian tubes and all that, and the women are there. Some of them are painting, but most of them are weaving. And they listen to her politely and, you know, nod, and she has a bit of chit-chat and packs all the stuff up and goes back to the car. She said to the health worker, the women weren't very communicative. Could they understand my English? You know, what's going on? And the health worker said, oh, yeah, they understood. And she said, well, you know, what's going on? She had one of the baskets that the women were weaving, and she showed it to the doctor and she said, see this pattern on this basket? She said, yeah. She said, the health worker goes, here's the ovaries, here's the uterus, here's the birth canal. In these, the women have always known this information. It's been in the weaving of the baskets for tens of thousands of years. So, yeah, they understood what you were saying.
Thank you. So the question of policy, Kelly Briggs, who's not here with us this evening, she wrote an excellent article about her experience as an Indigenous mother and her experiences with, you know, truancy officers and things like that, and the way that it impacted her more because of intergenerational trauma than it would perhaps impact somebody else. And so I guess I wanted to ask, what's the starting point? What is the starting point for involving Indigenous women in policy?
Treaty.
Yeah.
you go.
No, I'm just sort of, yeah, treaty. Yeah, I mean, I'm really, obviously I'm pretty hardcore on that sort of front, but for me, the whole issue... this country still, and we're talking, and I always stuff up my math. One of my biggest jokes is I dropped out of my science degree and eventually became an arts one, so I left all the math behind then. But
I bet you understand the skin system.
Sorry?
I bet you understand the skin system and the maths in there.
Oh, yeah. I'm good with that. But, you know, it's kind of we're talking, what, 22, 23 years beyond the Mabo decision, where Torres Strait Islander man was able to prove in the highest white fella court, you know, that Indigenous land ownership and Indigenous law were continuing systems that tied people into places, and therefore the notion of terra nullius was a legal fiction. So the fact that, I mean, we always knew that, but the fact that it's actually been proven in a whitefella law and there's still no agreement, and they were talking back in the 90s about, oh, this will lead to a constitutional crisis because all of a sudden we're recognising that these people actually were here, did have a concept of land ownership and connection and so forth. But, what was it? We're going to be moving into your backyard. So I haven't done that yet. But the fact that all of the, you know, the talk of constitutional crisis was back then, and we still haven't come to the table as equals and negotiated a way forward and, you know, and recognised these sorts of connections, I think is one of the biggest issues facing this country today. I mean, every single policy that's put onto Aboriginal people is put onto. So there's no negotiation, there's no community ownership of it. It's all imposed. We're continually imposed upon. And then they wonder why these things don't work. There's no imperative to consult. So, you know, for me, having that negotiation, I'm sounding like a unionist now, getting to the table and negotiating and actually, you know, recognising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as equals and as people that can't be imposed from because of all of this. And
that can only happen in two ways. That can happen through international courts recognising our sovereignty, or it can happen through what I hope we can avoid, which is political violence forcing some sort of negotiation from the Australian state, I think. You know, some radical voices are saying that there has been no secession of sovereignty and that that can be proved in international law. So when it comes to policy, it's a matter of Australian governments accepting that they actually don't know the best way to go forward because the expertise isn't there, it's not their domain. They are operating in ignorance, if not outright malice, and sometimes it is malice, often it's ignorance. And so without treaty or treaties, you know, there can be no way forward. Alexis Wright has done some excellent work around sovereignty and this. And she also talks about the sovereignty of the mind, you know, the sovereignty of the mind, us as Aboriginal people retaining sovereignty of our own mental faculties as we struggle with, you know, neo-colonial reality, which is really important as well.
And what role does feminism, Australian feminism in general, have to play in supporting Aboriginal women and Aboriginal feminism? What does being an ally look like?
For me, one of the biggest reasons why, because I think I always refer to my accidental writing career. I started up Rantings of an Aboriginal Feminist, 3 years ago in June, and 6 weeks after I started it, I was published. And, you know,
it, oh,
6 weeks, yeah, 6 weeks, you know. It's pretty good. But my writing from there has just continued, and it's never something I set out. But one of the key reasons why I've kept writing is because I think it's incredibly important. If I'm there in that space and I'm representing the sorts of views I am, which is fairly, you know, radically left-wing Aboriginal feminist views, there's a space not only for other people who have similar views to come along with me, but the right for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to show dissent with my views and do it publicly. So it's about opening up those spaces and allowing the conversations, and that's what I see for feminism too. You know, it's not just about inclusion of us so that you can say, okay, so we've consulted with this one Aboriginal person and she's said this and therefore this is how we're going to move forward. It's about actually carving out that space and allowing the discussion and actually sitting down and listening. So, yeah, I think that sometimes allies try almost too hard to represent everything they're not without bringing along those people who are to take up that space. And that's what I'd say needs to happen more often. There needs to be more discussion, more dialogue and more listening so that we are bringing the most vulnerable in society, you know, and along with us, and they have the right to actually the right to be liberated. My God, you know, the right to a better life within it. So it's not just the people who are already the people who are already at the top of the feminist movement who are benefiting the most from it at the end of the day. Mm-hmm.
The best thing that allies can do is clarify their values, clarify their own values. Who are you prepared to include in your feminism? Who are you prepared to share power with? What should Australia look like? You know, if you haven't asked yourself these questions, there's no way that you can operate in a just way. There's no way that you can be real about approaching First Nations or people with a disability and people with all kinds of different ways of being marginalised, unless you know what your values are. If it's just some fuzzy thing of, someone yelled at me last week, so I better pay a bit of attention to that for 5 minutes, you know, that's not a sophisticated way to live or to think. So what are your values and what kind of Australia do you want to live in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the questioning of individual privileges and that too. Breaking down what your privileges are and being honest about what they are. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with being honest about them.
Yeah, it can be scary, you know. I was having a conversation with Maxine this afternoon talking about skin tone and how, you know, as apparently white woman, I can walk out my front door any day of the week and walk down the street and I'm not going to get racist vitriol unless I choose to identify that I'm Aboriginal and that I don't like the way things are right now. Okay, that's not a privilege that's available to women who look Aboriginal in Townsville and get spat on in the street by strangers, or for African women, you know, in Sydney, or for women who wear the hijab. You know, it doesn't actually have to destroy you to acknowledge that you have strengths and privileges as well as weaknesses and exclusions. But if people can be real and say, well, my values are this, you know, my values are that when the woman on the train, like Celeste last week, when someone on the train is being racially abused, I'll get in the way. You know, I'll do something about it. When someone in my workplace is putting shit on Muslims, I'll get in the way of that. I'll interrupt it. You know, when I see a public event with no Aboriginal voices for the third year in a row, I'll voice some concern about it. You know, it's about who you are.
I think that's probably a good note in which to throw it open to questions. So we'll have a 15-minute question time. There'll be a mic on either side, so please raise your hand if you have a question and don't be shy.
Look at them, they're going to be shy now.
Hi, Hi, sorry. Thank you very much for speaking to us. It's been a joy to listen to both of you, Melissa and Celeste. I just wanted to pick up on something that you mentioned earlier, Melissa. You were saying about violence and Celeste also brought up domestic violence. I was just wondering, when you said that there's a debate about violence and the position of Aboriginal women, were you talking about like several layers of violence in terms of like colonial white Australia and within Indigenous communities? Like, did you mean... I was just wondering if you wanted to expand on that at all, or...
I'm not quite sure which bit you were talking about, but, yeah, of course we experience violence at the hands of the state, you know, the structural violence in terms of housing and health and unemployment and poverty generally, and family violence, whether that's at the hands of white partners or Aboriginal partners or other partners. You get the whole kaleidoscope, you know, often if you're an Aboriginal woman. You know, there's Aboriginal women out today who... a few weeks ago, a woman in my far extended family went and assaulted a police officer so that she would be locked up, because that was the safest place for her to be that night, because it was safer for her and more pleasant for her to be in a jail cell than to be at home in country New South Wales. The violence is extreme for a lot of women, not everyone. I haven't been hit for, I don't know, 20 years, 25 years. I think the violence I was talking about was political violence, which some on the radical fringes are saying is what is needed if there's going to be any shift in our circumstances in Australia. You know, people... I talk about this in an essay I just wrote for Meanjin. And again, I'd stress that I'm a pacifist. I'm not prepared to shed blood in order to advance a political cause. But some people are. And I think it's a really good thing that Abbott got the flick, because I think the longer Abbott was in with his lunatic agenda, not that Turnbull may be much better, you know, I'm willing to give him 5 minutes to see if he is. You know, I think he's at least sane, which is a start. But I think if Abbott had stayed in, that, you know, we would have been getting much closer to a point where armed struggle would become more of a reality.
Well, I mean, I'd agree with that. The talk of treaty has often been coupled with the talk of retribution, which involves that sort of idea a lot of the time. It's not the sort of road that I take on. Like I said, I'm hardcore sort of pacifist, but, you know, direct sort of sitting down and occupying and all that. I don't mind a bit of that.
Yeah,
but
that's non-violent action.
Yeah,
that's
I like a bit of non-violent
blowing up buildings
action.
Or shooting people.
No. But, retribution is forming part of the negotiation process. So the fact that a violence was done and therefore there's a violence... that's committed back in order to be square is something that I do hear talk of sometimes, and it's
Well, Angela Davis says it's self-defence. That's her position, you know. And the inquiry on Palm Island at the moment is talking about, you know, when Mulrunji was killed in 2004, that police had guns to the head of little children. And I was told that when I went to Palm Island, I think the same year. I think it was the same year, very soon afterwards anyway. And it actually didn't shock me. And when I look back now, this is the shocking thing. The things that occur to Aboriginal people, Aboriginal women, Aboriginal children, that we just let slide and take for granted because we don't have high expectations of Australia. I think that's something that we need to work on, as well as the other side.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do we have any other questions?
Hi, my friend Brooke is from the Waka people, and she reflects, I guess, a feeling of a growing patriarchy within Aboriginal culture. And her experience, she was saying, is that it has to do with, I guess, a stolen identity and clinging to gender roles as being a way to, I guess, take back some identity that has been stolen. Is that just my friend's experience, or is that a widely held experience that you'd like to comment on?
I think it's a real mix. I mean, Melissa was talking, there were cultures that are patriarchal. There have been a lot of patriarchal sort of issues and people that we've dealt with over the years. But also, too, I mean, the white patriarchy, the white capitalist patriarchy is at the absolute top of the social strata at this point in time. So people adopting those and negotiating those through a process of colonisation, plus then trying to reclaim identity and misinterpreting or using for their own sort of agendas. It's a real mixed bag of experience there. When I complain about Indigenous patriarchies, more often than not, I seem to be complaining about the recasting of women to the background support roles, the nurturers, the ones that are supposed to just keep rolling on and pushing everyone else forward. And I find that really hard to deal with because I've seen so many strong women, and particularly all my years working in education. I know that our women are qualified at twice the rate. I know that they've been writing the arguments for a long, long time and weren't necessarily getting recognition for that, because there'd be a draw not just on the white capitalist patriarchy, but also these sometimes misinterpreted, sometimes not, but forms of black patriarchy, which people would be grappling with all the time. So there can be a bit of that, but you know, we've also got males within the movement, black males who are allies. Sort of, you know, they don't stand for it. So I think that I don't know anywhere that we don't grapple with patriarchy in the broader Australian context, and I think that that plays out in slightly different ways within the Indigenous.
Yeah, and we're many, many Aboriginal cultures, not one, as you probably know. Basically, I agree with Celeste. I think a lot of Aboriginal men feel disempowered, disrespected, as though they're failures in the eyes of their own families and the wider society, and so they will grasp onto some distortion of tradition and fail to see that, you know, in the traditional culture that I'm aware of and that I've been exposed to, men didn't try and denigrate women or put women down, because women have their lore. You know, women have their dreaming songs and dreaming stories. Women have their totems. Women have their power. And so it's often an artifact of colonisation that men will try and raise themselves up at the expense of women. You know, all of the people that are, you know, relatively traditional that I've been around are very, very balanced and respectful people in that way.
Hey, I just wanted to thank you so
much. Actually, I'll just... sorry to interrupt you. I'll just add something to that. I'm thinking in particular of a fellow from Borroloola who lives in Brisbane, and he's a man of Aboriginal law. He's been through his third law, which means that he's very highly regarded by his mob and he's skilled. He's skilled as a human being. And I was talking to him a few years ago about the violence in Byron Shire, and I was saying it's bad, but it's probably not as bad as like in Tennant Creek or something like that. And I was particularly thinking of a mate of mine who was being bashed at the time. And he looked at me and he just said, "Melissa, any amount of violence is bad, is no good, you know. This much is too much, you know. And he taught me then, don't, as an Aboriginal man, to accept absolutely no violence in the home, you know. And that he was coming out of a teaching tradition of many, many, many tens of thousands of years. So I think it's the men who are more lost that are the ones that are the least respectful.
Hi, thank you so much. I've really appreciated tonight. I just wanted to ask you, I've been thinking a lot about the transformational activity of rage, and that it shouldn't necessarily, that these ideas that we're talking about tonight shouldn't necessarily be, have to be articulated in the most acceptable way, that rage is actually a really transformational tool, and that this kind of like tone policing about the most acceptable way to kind of present these ideas to oppressors should be kind of like deconstructed and criticised. I was just wondering whether you could talk about rage and... yeah, acceptability or something.
I think we'll disagree here, but you go first.
I'm wearing an anti-fascist T-shirt right now. you know, I've always kind of said, what's wrong with angry? And I think it's because if you can look at the world and you can see stuff that actually angers you or makes you feel rage or whatever else, then it can actually compel you into action. So... for me, there is a slight transformative power within recognising rage and anger and then acting upon it. But when I say acting upon, I don't actually mean returning that anger or returning that rage. I do mean looking at other sort of ways to actually challenge the systems that you see creating pain or you see creating... any sort of rage or issues for other people. So I do see that it can be slightly a transformative tool. I think that the danger lies within it becoming the only transformative tool.
Rage is an expression of powerlessness. Malcolm Turnbull isn't filled with rage, I would assume. Bill Shorten probably isn't filled with rage. And, you know, I continually go back to my Aboriginal tradition as taught to me by the women from my area and other people that I've been influenced by. Anger is a really powerful tool, you're right. You know, it can transform and it can shift things. But as an Aboriginal woman of mature age, it's my, not even as a woman, as an Aboriginal adult of mature age, it's my responsibility to care for everyone. You know, this gets back to what I was saying before about we invented intersectionality. So if someone comes to me and I see them as an oppressor, to use your term, and if they are someone my age, and if there's someone who's powerful who I can speak to, if I think my anger can be directed at them and change something for the better, I'll do that. But I'm a powerful person, you know. I scare people even without trying to. So it behoves me as a powerful adult to be very careful with my anger. All right, because just because I'm an Aboriginal woman and queer doesn't mean that I don't have power that I can abuse and become the abuser. You know? There's a place for anger, but we have to be very careful about what we do with our anger.
We might take one last question from the floor.
Hello, thank you for this evening as well. I'd also like to say thanks. And excuse me, I don't really know how to articulate this question very well, but I'm training to become a teacher and really hoping to work within Indigenous communities. And you said before, like, your mum used to drop hints to you and things like that about feminism. And I was just wondering if you could point me in the right direction or give me a little bit of guidance in how, as, like, a teacher, I can help do that within the classroom, you know, in a subtle but, you know, hopefully empowering way.
Well, just to talk a little bit more about my mum. So my mum was, well, my mum's still alive, so I shouldn't be saying was. But she's a very old woman, very, very old woman, and she had been from a young age. So she's the sort of person
who... Did you say
who,
odd?
Odd, yeah.
I thought you said old.
No, no. No, she'd kill me. yeah, but always... I guess maybe one of nature's natural anarchists, but very, very strange sort of woman herself, who was a little kid growing up in a working class area where her family, she was growing up in Collingwood and Clifton Hill. So that's where mum's from. Dad's Alice Springs lad. But yeah, mum was growing up there. It was a very working class, very ethnically diverse area at that time because you were getting a lot of the post-war immigration and that. And whilst her family were thinking about packing up bags and running off to the suburbs because they couldn't deal with the new Australians, mum was skipping along to Greek school as a little white girl. So I think that, I mean, part of the stuff that mum, you know, that appreciation of difference, that curiosity to know more about other cultures, other groups, other ideologies, things that were outside of what her immediate backyard was very much something that compelled mum to then start passing that on to the next generation. Mum would always, I think, you know, one of the things that mum banned dolls pretty much from the house because she didn't want to be raising young mothers, and she banned guns because she was anti-war. But, you know, where she would find those sorts of storybooks and all that, she would actively seek out books from other sort of cultures and that had a diversity of skin colours represented within them. You know, she would try and build esteem continually, and I think that's what I'm thinking within this sort of context. So it's about building esteem and engaging students in the sorts of discussions that actually make them proud of who they are and where they've come from, because there's, you know, there's so much out there that will try and make them feel ashamed, that creating an environment where they're appreciated and they can exchange these sorts of experiences is gold to them.
Yeah, while being aware that that also opens up kids to the great kaleidoscope of Australian racism, and to be really careful of that and not expect kids to be the experts on their own culture and to be able to articulate that, because that can be a real burden for Aboriginal kids. Mm. I'd say go back to clarify your values. You know, if you know who you are and what you stand for and where you stand, teaching will be a breeze, you know, because you'll just naturally come from that place where you know what's important to you, where you know what you want to promote in your classroom and what you want to say isn't okay. And, you know, educate yourself, obviously, about the Aboriginal culture of your area.
And also get them to read works like Melissa's and Celeste's, I think would be a fantastic idea. Thank you very much. This has been the F Word Aboriginality. Please thank Melissa and Celeste.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.